I think now what I ask my team, with every tweet they send out, every campaign they conceptualize, even every action they take, whatever it is, does this thing I'm about to do bring us closer together or move us further apart? And too often people take the approach that moves us further apart, and you know it. You send that mean tweet and you know that like a few hundred people are going to hate it, or they're going to feel like you're targeting them, or you're talking bad about a piece of the population. They will never join you now. If your solution only works for people who look just like you or think just like you, or only know how to use the vocabulary in the exact way that you want this vocabulary to be used, that isn't progressive movement building.
This is Mission to Scale, a podcast that reveals the tools, mindsets, and strategies that organizations and funders need to make the most impact. Because the world's biggest problems need solutions at scale. I'm your host, Dan Borelovitz. How do you build a movement of people with deeply opposing views? How do you get them to buy into your vision? Finding common ground in a divisive political climate can be incredibly daunting. To some, it may seem impossible, but Nisha Anand, today's guest, turned this challenge into a mission. Nisha is the CEO of DreamCore, a nonprofit organization founded by US TV host and social entrepreneur Van Jones. The organization advances solutions to society's biggest problems by bringing people together across racial, social, and partisan lines. Nisha shares practical and valuable insights on how to approach movement building. As a veteran fundraiser, she also talks about an important lesson from Van Jones that pushed her to think about fundraising differently. She also shares straightforward yet powerful advice on fundraising that led to a $100 million gift from Jeff Bezos.
I remember one of my earliest activist memories was I decided as a young feminist, I wasn't going to shave my legs. And this was, you know, the early 90s in Georgia. And I got in trouble for it. Some boys reported me to the disciplinarian who didn't like it. They thought it was gross. And I got called into her office and told it was gross. And I remember yelling a long speech at her about patriarchy and how she needs to take her assumptions about what a woman should be and put them somewhere else. And I made a big fit. And I got detention for 10 days and I had to clean up the cafeteria. And I remember the next day telling all my friends about it and ended up having all the girls not shave their legs for a week. So I did some direct organizing in this Catholic high school in Georgia. It was one of my young organizing experiences. And that probably set me, I mean, there are a lot of things that set me on the course to be the little bit of a hellraiser I was as a young person. I went to every protest that there was that felt like it was for my causes. I was really involved in animal rights. I remember locking myself by the neck to fellow activists in the center ring of the three-ring circus. And
fantastic.
That was really hard for me. Sure, maybe some people thought it was fantastic. But I remember sitting there. We had practiced and we had gotten all ready to do it. And I'm sitting there locked by the neck. There's no way out now. And I thought to myself, I've ruined the entire night for these kids, because the stadium or wherever it was filling up with these kids who now are going to have to go home and not see the circus. And I felt really bad. I knew I wanted to make a stand for animals and animal rights, but I did not want to ruin any child's night. Mm. And I remember as we were being carted off, we got lifted up and put on a cart and driven off of the three-ring circus. I remember thinking there must be a better strategy to this. And I refined that over the years to where I am now, but I really did everything. And I think that all different parts of our movements play a role in getting us to a future with freedom and dignity for all. And I think social change is really complex.
Yeah.
And we need people that are out on the streets and putting their lives on the line and willing to get arrested. I think that's very necessary. We also need folks who are willing to work with absolutely anyone who will come to the table, which is where I find myself now, and a whole bunch of stuff in between. So my journey includes a lot of the in-between to get me to where I am today.
Totally. No, fascinating. That background is super interesting. There's not many people that are willing to put their own physical safety on the line in the way that you did. And then at the same time, come on this journey to Dream Corps now, where you're in an organization and you're in an organization getting significant investment from serious individuals. So clearly, you know, they love this idea of tempering the activist to create change in other ways. So could you tell us a bit about Dream Corps and the work that you're doing now?
Sure. Dream Corps is an organization that was founded by Van Jones. He is a mentor and friend, and I got to call him boss for a better part of a decade. So I learned a lot from him during those years. And the idea behind Dream Corps is that we need massive systems change. We've been working on it our whole lives, and yet we haven't gotten there. And there have been these tipping point moments that I have lived through. I was part of the protest during the WTO and the IMF and World Bank protests in the 90s. And we thought at that moment that when we saw this global justice movement was what it was called at that point, we thought we've moved. There's this tipping point. I lived through Rodney King. I lived through Occupy. And the Occupy movement was really inspiring to see that folks started to have this language around wealth inequality and this income gap, at least here in the United States. It shifted people's ideas about what's possible with our economy. And then, of course, last summer, living through the murder of George Floyd, when you had companies who had never spoken out on issues of racial justice willing to put not just their brand on the line, but a ton of money behind it. There is now this willingness and this openness that people want to make change, and we haven't gotten closer to the type of systems change we need. And so the idea behind Dream Corps is there has to be a better way to do it, that there has to be a way in this day and age with the tools we have at our disposal and the desire from all different sectors of our society, from the corporate sector, from DC, from Hollywood, from Wall Street. People want to make a difference and they just don't know how. And so Dream Corps takes big ideas like criminal justice reform, climate reform, and we work on tech equity and workforce development and diversity in the tech sector. And those are ideas we think have massive support. We just haven't been able to bring all the people together who want to work on it. We haven't been able to bring them together. The best solutions are out there. Now we need to like manufacture the political will to get it done.
Yeah, to take them to scale. Yeah,
absolutely. And so we've had some luck, but we certainly are looking for how to do more.
That's great. And I know, as part of the journey, you mentioned this in your TED talk, the First Step Act is I think a great example of how some of those tools around creating systems, creating change, can be used in practice. So maybe if you could briefly just share that process of the First Step Act and where you got to with it.
Sure. When I interviewed for this job with Van Jones, he told me, and this was about almost 9 years ago, he told me that we were going to pass bipartisan criminal justice reform. And to me, that was an oxymoron because I had been fighting for criminal justice reform, police brutality against the death penalty, all different parts for my whole young life, activist life. And I remember being out in the streets during, it was the Republican National Convention in 2000. And like I mentioned earlier, I was out there risking arrest and organizing this massive mobilization outside the Republican National Convention. And there wasn't a single Republican on the streets with us. You know, that's not who was there trying to make the change. So I thought it was an oxymoron, but he walked me through it. He said that for years, we have been working on the left at the justice angle. We saw the criminal justice system, a racist system that has been unfair since its inception, that has had worse outcomes for people of color at every single level of the way the system operates since it started. And so we care about fairness and equality. In fact, that's what I've always cared about. It's why I came to the progressive side and the left side. But he pointed out that there were a lot of folks on the other side that had different reasons for wanting reform. Mm-hmm. Not the same reasons as me, but they still wanted reform. Fiscal conservatives think that we spend way too much taxpayer dollars on it. They don't want to have to spend so much money on the prison system. They'd rather spend it somewhere else or not spend it at all. You have the libertarian right, who doesn't like the overreaching police state. They want less regulation, especially around drugs and drug offenses. And you have the religious right, who's really into second chances. wants to see redemption, really wants to see there be a pathway for folks getting better. And that is completely devoid in the criminal justice system in the United States. Like, you cannot find that almost anywhere. And so there were different parts of the right coalition that were ready and willing to work on it, not for the same reasons. But I felt when there was that much desire for reform, there has to be a pathway to get reform. So we started building this coalition. People laughed at us. Not everyone joined the table at first, but we started building what could we all agree on? What would be the first step that we could take together?
Wonderful. It's a real journey and an approach I hope you can apply to other areas. It sounds like you've got a set of ideas. If other people were trying to do this themselves, I mean, it sounds just like a really heavy lift. It sounds challenging. You had Van Jones, well known. You had yourself and the team. Do you think it's possible for other people to go do this, other organizations, other teams?
I think we need a lot more nonprofits, a lot more organizations, a lot more even just in your local community and whatever groups you're involved with. We need a lot more bridge builders and healers and people trying to work across divides. I think now what I ask my team, with every tweet they send out, every campaign they conceptualize, even every action they take, every member email, whatever it is, does this thing I'm about to do bring us closer together or move us further apart? And too often people take the approach that moves us further apart, and you know it. You send that mean tweet and you know that like a few hundred people are going to hate it, or they're going to feel like you're targeting them, or you're talking bad about a piece of the population. They will never join you now. And it's sometimes people still want to send it because it feels good. It feels good because 1,000 people are going to like it. I find that to be not helpful at all, really. And so I ask myself that question before I do anything. I ask my whole team, is this dividing us further or bringing us closer together? Because there are enough solutions on the table, enough great ideas from everywhere on the progressive side of the plate that I think can bring us closer together if we're willing to do that and not score the cheap points for talking bad about, you know, someone on the other side, but really think about healing this country. I think that has to be the option moving forward. So that's what I ask people to do, is try to look for that win-win-win.
Yeah, I mean, that is a sort of message for our time, a paradigm to think through, which is how do you bring people together rather than divide them, which I think would be a great takeaway for organizations who are working on this themselves. What else have you learned and you think others could learn when it comes to expanding your mission, achieving impact, when it comes to movement building that others maybe can take and use themselves?
There's a story that's coming to mind, Dan. So I feel like I'm going to tell you the story before I actually get to some of the lessons.
Great. Go for it.
One of the things that set me on this path early was when I was arrested in the military dictatorship of Myanmar. It was 1998, and it was the 10-year anniversary of a massacre. It's a pro-democracy uprising in 1988. And mostly students from inside the capital city had rose up, and they just had hopes for democracy. And I went there with a group of 18 activists 10 years later to mark the anniversary. And we smuggled in these little leaflets. They're about the size of business cards. And they said, "We are your friends from around the world. We support your hopes for human rights and democracy." And that's all the business cards said, but it's highly illegal in a military dictatorship. And so we handed out these. It was a well-planned action. It was well-coordinated. It wasn't like the circus. We knew what we were doing. However, I look back on it now, 20 years now, definitely more risky than anything else I had done at that point. But all 18 of us got arrested. We were from 6 different countries. We spent a week in jail. We were sentenced to 5 years of hard labor at our sham trial. And we may not have gotten out. It could have been a very different story, but the international community put a lot of pressure to release us. But from the United States, a representative from New Jersey, his name's Chris Smith, he's a Republican from New Jersey, he flew all the way over to Myanmar to get us out. And I thought about it on our ride home, this Republican, and it was during my college days. So I was really radical and I had a lot of feelings. And I thought, I'm sharing a plane ride with him now back to the US. I'm going to have his undivided attention. And, you know, he's a congressperson. I'm going to talk to him about, and I had like a list of 10 things that we disagreed on that I was going to talk to him about on that ride home. And I actually made the choice not to. And I remember that conversation so well because it was so out of my wheelhouse. That is not how I had talked to people at that point. I was always making a point. I was captain of my debate team. I was I have to win an argument. I am a persuader by nature. I'm going to debate you forever. But I remember sitting on that plane ride and not talking to him about the issues that divide us, but really talking about human rights. International human rights was an area where we had a lot of alignment, really lockstep in some of the things we were seeing. And on that, we could work together. And that certainly set me on this path to where I am now and looking for what is the more inclusive way to build a movement. And I got to the path of being progressive and having progressive values because I wanted to build the biggest tent possible, widen the circles of people who are in and not out. And somehow along the way, we've lost that. So I'd say the big piece of advice I'd have is to remember that radical inclusivity, that if your solution only works for people who look just like you or think just like you, or only know how to use the vocabulary in the exact way that you want this vocabulary to be used, that isn't progressive movement building. It's not what I signed up for. I signed up for the most radically inclusive movements for social change and social justice possible. And so that's probably my big lesson from that, is that we can include a lot more people than we think.
Apart from radical inclusivity, Nisha talks about the value of authenticity when it comes to movement building.
And so that means when I get in a room of people who think different, I'm me. I absolutely say where I'm coming from and my values. And I say in the same breath, and that doesn't stop me from wanting to know about you and why you have the values you have. I can tell that story about being left out in the South and feeling like I didn't fit in anywhere. And that is relatable to absolutely everybody because we all have stories of being misfits. And if you care enough to listen and find out what makes, you know, this person who you perceive as your political opposite come to the conclusions that they've come to, you will learn something. So yeah, I'm authentic. I don't try to hide where I'm coming from. There's certain things I will never compromise on. And I think that makes me a valuable teammate on kind of these mixed policy teams. Because I want to be the best progressive I can be. I want them to be the best conservatives they can be and really show up in like the heart of their values. I think there's something really important about having diversity at the table. And we talk a lot about equity, and we often think that means racial diversity or diversity from different parts of the economy and sectors. And that is absolutely important and it's critical, but it also means diversity of thought. That folks come to the ideas they come to, if they're being authentic and say why they believe something different than you believe, you can learn a lot from that and come up with more interesting solutions, quite honestly.
Before joining Dream Corps and political organization Rebuild the Dream, Nisha worked as a fundraising consultant and mentor for new fundraisers and nonprofits.
Most people don't enjoy fundraising very much. Tell us about your attitude towards fundraising, because you've gone on this journey from being a relatively small nonprofit to starting it. And obviously you had a big name, a celebrity with you, but you've recently got some really significant investments. So clearly, as the custodian of the organization, you're doing something right when it comes to the funding, this necessary evil of the funding to make the whole thing work. Tell us a bit about that journey and your attitudes toward fundraising.
Sure. You might not know this about me, but I was actually a development director for quite a few years. And in fact, that's how I got the job working with Van, was purely on the fundraising team. So I was a young organizer and I was working for the War Resisters League in New York, which is this 80-year-old pacifist organization. And I was their national field organizer, right? So just organizing the chapters. And I thought about what I saw going on at these other nonprofits and other chapters, and I realized how important fundraising was to the functioning. And somebody there, and I can't even remember who it was, but it was somebody on the board or someone on the staff, had said, you know, the person who's the development person, the fundraising person, they have the most power really in the organization outside of the executive director, outside of the president.
Brilliant.
And they told me that, and it sparked one off in my head. And I'm like, well, I want power. I want to tell people what to do in this organization. That's just, I'm a bit of a bossy pants. And I started looking for fundraising jobs, and no one would take me. I didn't have any experience in fundraising. I'd just been an activist. And one organization took a bet on me that was out here on the West Coast. I moved from New York to California just to get experience in fundraising. It was the Ruckus Society. It's an organization, it's kind of like Greenpeace, trained people in direct action tactics for progressive causes. And they brought me on as a development director with no experience. And that's when I learned that you don't find people who look like me, women of color, people of color at all, in these fundraising roles at nonprofits. And you see very few of us on the board. And so that in itself, learning how to fundraise, was kind of a political act of my own. Well, I'm going to start walking into those boardrooms. I'm going to start going to foundations and talking about what I think is important and commanding a room. And I've always looked young. I still look a lot younger than I did. And that's a lot to walk in and say, okay, and then please, can you give me, I remember the first big gift I asked for was around $350,000. It was an amount of money I had never seen, I had never talked about. And when the words came out of my mouth, I had been trained, don't talk yourself out of the gift, just make the ask and then be quiet. But for me, I remember saying that amount and thinking I was going to like faint because I just asked a human being, one individual for, you know, $350,000 or something like that. And he said yes. And I don't think I ever stopped fundraising after that. It was very exciting to me.
Fast forward to 2021, Nisha helped Van Jones and DreamCorps secure the inaugural Courage and Civility Award by Amazon founder Jeff Bezos. The recognition came with a $100 million prize.
And I think these two words together, courage and civility, don't always go together. And that so beautifully captures what the Dream Corps is about. Being courageous, not holding back on the vision we want to see for the world, but also being civil. You don't have to be nasty. You don't have to divide. You don't have to further other the opposition to make change in this world.
Here, Nisha talks about a critical conversation she had with Van Jones that gave her a new perspective on fundraising.
If you want another Van Jones story, it comes down to this for me. It was early on when I was working for him, and we were coming up with our fundraising strategy for the year. And I got out, I had been in development for a while now. So I got out this donor pyramid chart and I wrote out how many gifts we needed at each range. And I said, you know, we'll need 2 gifts in this high range and we'll need 100 gifts in this low range. And I'm walking him through it and I have my plan. And he says, why don't we just ask these 2 people for all of it? And I have been trained like, no, we can't do it that way. And there are all these reasons you don't want to do it that way. And it's about accountability and who owns the organization and all of these things I had been taught. And he was like, if we can do it with just 2 people, why do you want to do this for a year? Build this whole campaign for a year? Why don't you just help me use the connections I'm developing? He's like, I'm good. I'll develop those connections. And that threw me for a huge loop because I had studied, this is how you fundraise, this is what you had to do. And he just kind of blew my mind. It was actually a funny conversation because I remember digging my heels in and saying, no, this is the way I know. I've had, you know, 10 years of development experience. This is how you do it. And he said to me, no, Nisha, you've had 1 year of development experience that you've done 10 years in a row.
Mm.
And I remember being really upset by that in the moment and thinking, no, I'm a professional, I'm an expert, or whatever it was at that point. But he was right. And the follow-up sentence to you have 1 year that you've done 10 years in a row was, if you join this team and if you're fully on this team, you will never have the same year again each year in a row. If you do, we're doing something wrong. Every year, I'm going to try to do bigger and bolder things to scale, which means every year you're going to have to do bigger and bolder things to scale. If you're doing the same year over and over again, like Groundhog's Days, we have failed. And so that's an important lesson for me too, not just about fundraising, but about scaling, is that we can't keep doing it the same way. Sure, you know, door-to-door canvassing worked for a long time. It doesn't have to. We can build a different network of people, especially if we're willing to work with everyone, mm-hmm. so that folks with a lot of money can contribute a lot of money. That can be their contribution to movement building and to changing this world. And yeah, so I'm happy to take $100 million checks. Anyone else you know, Dan, you can send my way. I will certainly, you know, have a call with them and tell them what I'm up to. But we have to think big like that. If our solutions are that good, we need to have the money to scale them. And I'm really excited to finally see someone invest in Van in that way. And I hope more will come.
You had concerns. You mentioned one of them, which is that, you know, too few people giving large amounts then own the organization. Were any of those concerns realized? What have you learned now a few years on from that experience?
This comes back to authenticity. I remember being a young development professional and being so nervous in some of these one-on-one meetings when people were giving a lot of money and, you know, worrying, are they going to ask me for things that I can't give? I remember that feeling. It is such an old feeling. I'm not acquainted with it at all anymore. Because now if I go into the room, I know what I'm selling. I know what we're about. I know what I believe in. And I know the plan to get us there. There's not any money that's going to sway me to a different plan with what we've studied. And so that's the kind of gift you give. This $100 million was absolutely no strings. It was like, do good, do the thing you do. And it means that we have turned down foundation money in the past, but it's a lot less than you'd think. I think that folks from foundations and individuals, they're drawn to that authenticity. They're drawn to the vision. I've never felt like I've had to do any sort of contortions for a funder in this role. When someone gives to the organization, it's because they believe in what you do. If you're authentic and you have that hard conversation, you can move folks towards a certain vision.
I love this idea is, you know, money and power, fundraising is power. And therefore, I think there's certainly a personal development piece, but also it is a distraction having to do that to an extent. So I guess, is there a tension there between getting people to do fundraising and just wanting them to be the very best at their core job that they're working on?
You know that there's always a tension between that. Always, always, always. I've never been anywhere where folks don't feel that tension and think that it's not right, that we have to be thinking about fundraising all the time. There's this article I read early on as a young fundraiser, fundraising and organizing, sisters in the struggle. And it talks about fundraising and organizing are essentially the same thing. That when you are trying to get people on your side, you're asking them to invest in your group in one way or another. Whether they're giving time or you need them to introduce a piece of legislation or you're trying to get them to sign on to some petition or some bill or something, it's the same thing you do when you ask someone for money, that they're one and the same. And if your idea and what you want to sell to, let's say, the legislator to introduce your legislation, you can't also ask another person for a dollar for it. It's probably not a program you believe in. It's kind of the same pitch. And also, when you get somebody to give you a dollar, 20, 300,000, whatever, that feeling of this is my group is so critical to making massive change. You need a lot of people who believe in what you do. And sometimes that extra dollar or whatever gift is meaningful for them will make it more meaningful to follow your work in the future. They'll feel like, this is mine. Like that image, that thing they're doing, that victory, passing that big piece of legislation, the First Step Act, I gave a meaningful gift. I gave a dollar to get that done, $20 to get that done. That is the best PR. That is the best recruitment. That is, it has so much potential when you think like that. And so I feel like every time you can, you give an opportunity for people to donate. I also feel just thinking that way. Would I put a dollar behind this idea?
Yeah.
Would I feel comfortable asking my friend for a dollar for this idea? If you wouldn't, it's not a good idea. And so I think our best campaigners and our best program works have to think like fundraisers.
Absolutely. Identification of donors, finding the right people to come in, it can be a challenge. In your case, you've got someone like Van, who is, you know, well known and presumably helps in that front. But how have you gone about, or how do you go about now identifying the right donors to approach?
Well, I've got to say it's different working for Van and finding new donors than it has been in other organizations.
Sure.
And everywhere I've gone, I've thought, oh, this organization is going to be easier. This organization is going to be easier. When I was at the Ruckus Society, it felt like a very limited amount of people you could ask for money, because back then, who wants to invest in direct action and, you know, training people how to hang from a building and hang a banner? It felt like when I switched and I worked at the Rape Crisis Center in the city was my next job after that. I felt like everyone would want to donate. Wouldn't everyone want to put money into the Rape Crisis Center in the city? And found out that wasn't really the case. Like every place you go has its own challenges. And in working with Van Jones and his nonprofits, we meet a lot of people. Every single person we meet, our challenge is they have to go into the database. We have to figure out, you know, what's the right ask. Our challenge is a little different. A lot of folks don't want to give money because they have this idea that Van has a ton of money. And up until recently, that was absolutely not true. He did not have money to give, but that was, you know, our challenge. So I don't know that the struggle we go through is the same for other struggle. We end up having a lot of names, but what I would say from my younger fundraiser days is that every single person you meet is a potential supporter. And your organization should really think that way. How does every person I meet fit in with our larger vision for the world? And because I'm building something that's radically inclusive, I do believe everyone has a role. So having phone call logs, so everyone that's calling you or emailing you has a way to get into your system. Having some people do events each year to get new names in. Some people, you know, buy ads now and target media ads everywhere. And Facebook and Instagram and Twitter can be a large place for numbers to come in if you have something that provokes a feeling and an emotion and you need people organized. But yeah, you have to have a constant influx of new names to keep going if you're based on donor fundraising, which means you have to have something that captivates hearts and minds.
Absolutely. Tell me about the future. What do you think the future holds when it comes to funding? There's this 100 million and there are more and more people capable of giving gifts at that or approaching that size. Where do you think we'll go in terms of the changing of the funding landscape in the coming years for Dream Corps and beyond?
You know, the thing I've heard Van say the most about the 100 million is that's just a start. And we do have nonprofits that spend 100 million a year every year. And folks don't blink an eye. Some of the bigger, larger legacy nonprofits out there, that's their normal operating budget. And you look at big companies, obviously, they spend a whole lot more than that. So 100 million shouldn't be rare. It should be more common. And I do think that there are a lot of folks out there who want to make gifts. Our job is to make the organization you work at the most compelling place to give a gift. Have the numbers, have the approach, have it make sense for folks to give that gift. And if part of your language is you do not belong because you work at X corporation, therefore you don't belong in our movement, you're not going to get that gift. But if the thing is we have a very radical approach, here's how we're getting from, you know, A to Z. This is where we are in that moment. Here's where we're going after. And you can join us now and get on this rocket ship. Stick to that and be able to show how you're getting from here to there and what the money is going to do to help you get from here to there. And then ask for the gift. Make the connection. And in fact, you know, it's an interesting story. The way we initially got introduced to Jeff Bezos was a LinkedIn connection. My development director said, hey, there's this woman at Amazon Sustainability that you're connected to or someone's connected to. He reached out to her and she was like, yeah, I've heard of you guys. And we got on the phone with her. And at several months later, I was sitting at my desk and I got this email that said, Jeff Bezos would like to speak to you. Are you available next Monday? And I had one of those moments where I'm like shaking. And me? Doesn't he have people to talk to people like me? Like, why does he want to talk to me? And I thought, oh, maybe he wants to talk to Van. And at that point, they didn't know each other. He's like, no, he wants to know what you're up to at Dream Corps. I'm like, well, I need a little more detail. I don't know how to prep for a conversation for the richest person alive. But
amazing.
But I'll finally, we narrowed it down to that he was interested in Green for All. And I was able to bring in the woman who runs our Green for All team, Michelle Romero, who's brilliant, to the call. So it was her and I, and we spoke with Jeff and Lauren, and we ended up getting $10 million, which at that point, I told you about the $300,000. $10 million was like the biggest gift we had ever gotten. So we, of course, thought that was like the most amazing thing that ever happened. And then a year later, you know, Van gets $100 million, but still, it was a LinkedIn connection that got us from here to here to here to here. And that was just one person reaching out. People have never been more accessible. And if you have something that you can explain and that makes sense and that shows how to change the world, like, reach out.
Nisha has played many roles, gathering wisdom and a breadth of experience from each one and using it to break through the next challenge she faces. That's why I believe she's been so successful in creating social change where others struggle. I hope that you learned as much from Nisha and Dream Corps' experience as I did. To find out more, please visit thedreamcorps.org. We've provided a link in our show notes. That's it from us, and I hope you enjoyed today's episode. Please don't forget to subscribe or follow our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And while you're there, I'd appreciate it if you could rate us and give us a review. If you love Mission to Scale, I hope you recommend our show to a friend or colleague.
Mission to Scale is produced by Spring Impact and Human Group Media. If you want to learn more about our work at Spring Impact, visit springimpact.org and follow us at Spring Impact on Twitter. Thank you so much for joining, and I'll catch you all in the next episode.